Good morning. I'd like to start the meeting of the Finance and Administration Committee, if everybody could take a seat. Good morning. I'd like to call to order the Finance and Administration Committee of March 8th, 2012. Before we begin our agenda, I'd like to ask Mr. Doherty to give our safety or emergency announcement for today.
Good morning, Chairman Acosta, members of the board. I just wanted to note that the fire alarm would go off. You would see the clear strobes and hear the audible signal that would indicate that we should evacuate the building. In the event that occurs, would ask that you either exit at the exit door behind the board members or through the door behind me, go across the street from the Jackson Graham building and assemble in front of the building museum by the nut and bolt sculpture. That would conclude the emergency announcement, sir.
Thank you very much. Before we begin our meeting, I'd just like to announce to the members of the public that the Audit Committee, which had met in executive session earlier today, will be meeting later on, I believe this afternoon. So in this place, we'll be focusing on the Finance and Administration Committee agenda. In front of us is the approval of the agenda. I'd just like to make two notes. There's one addition to the agenda that was added a few days ago, which is at the end of the information items, 4C will be a discussion of WMATA's advertising program. Also, for members of the committee as well as members of the public, at about 10:45 today, I will ask that we suspend discussions on the matter that we are discussing, the matter that may be on the agenda that we're focusing on, in order to accommodate our guest, the administrator of the Transportation Security Administration, will be our guest today, and he will be making a presentation to the board. In order to accommodate his schedule, I'd like to suspend the meeting and then turn it over to Mr. Downey for introductions. So if there are no objections or any questions about today's agenda, I'd like to move forward. Well, next up is the approval of the minutes. You have the minutes before you of February 2nd, 2012. Are there any questions or comments regarding the minutes? If not, I would entertain a motion to adopt the minutes.
So moved.
Mr. Downey and Mr. Dyke, second. All in favor?
Aye.
Next up is our action item. We have an amendment to the FY 2012 reimbursable budgets. Ms. Kissel will be making the presentation.
So there's just a this one will be the first one Bill Green will take you through, which is the amendment to our current year budget on two matters. And then the second items will be the capital and operating budget discussions. We'll be talking about our progress year to date and then also talking about FY13. So we're combining those two together. And then we'll also have the advertising piece. So, Bill?
Thank you. I'm on page 6 in your packets right now. Included in your packet is a MEAD and also a resolution to increase the reimbursable and expenditure authority for the Metro Police and for bus in 2012. The Metro Transit Police, we'd like to propose two amendments to the 2012 budget. The first is the Metro Transit Police. We're asking authority to increase their expenditure authority by $3.8 million to account for a recent grant that we got for over $12 million, of which we've got $3.8 in early implementation actions in 12. Bus services, we'd like to increase the budget both for the operating program and for the capital program. The operating program is about $339 million in reimbursable activities, and the capital program about $140 million. Oh, wrong presentation. That is thousands, I'm sorry. The board approved the bus agreement on the 26th of January, but at that time we neglected to get the budget authority for 12. So we're back before you today as a technical amendment. I'll talk first about the transit security. We were successful in receiving a $12 million grant. There was about $20 million available to transit agencies throughout the country through a Homeland Security program. We received an award of about $12.7 million, our police department, for use between fiscal years 12 and 15. $8.2 million is designated for operational activities, and $4.5 million for planning related to capital activities. What we're here today asking you for action on is $3.8 million amendment to the reimbursable budget for 12 fund those early implementation activities, which are primarily security against terrorist attacks. The bus services amendment, as I said earlier, we were here before you and received approval on January 26 to enhance service between West Falls Church Station and Marcus Center. At that time, we did not get authority in the 2012 budget for that service, which we are implementing. The reimbursable operating increase is $339,000. That is for wages, fringe benefits, and the cost of operating the service. Those will be offset by passenger fare revenues of about $112,000, and these will be paid by the Department of Defense. Under this agreement, we also have a capital portion to the agreement, whereby the Department of Defense will pay for the amortization in effect of the buses, and that comes to about $140,000. We would recommend that the board amend the 2012 reimbursable operating budget to include the expenses of $3.8 million to be funded at 100% by the Department of Homeland Security Transit Security Grant Program, and also to amend the FY12 reimbursable budget for the operating of the service, the L line, M. And those are $339,000 to be offset in full by the Department of Defense. And also to amend the 2012 reimbursable capital budget to recognize those costs paid by the DOD for depreciation on the buses.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Are there any questions for staff? Ms. Hines?
On the transit police grant, which it's always nice to get help in these things, if I looked at your initial slide, a chunk of this is for planning, which is a one-time, from my point of view, generally a one-time activity, gives us some, but there's a chunk that's operational. And so one of my questions always is on these grants, whether it's here or back in my jurisdiction, is what are you telling us about 2016 when this grant goes away? Does staff have an idea about, we're picking up in this budget the last big grant. So what's the thinking on this?
Well, it'll be the same way. The board will always have to approve any additional staffing or budget once the grant runs out, as we are doing this year. However, I know that Chief Taborn is looking at that action plan going forward, and either will handle that, if he can, internally through attrition, through his staffing, and I'm looking around for him, but that's his, oh, I'm sorry, there you are. So he could probably address that, but just to assure you, the board would have to approve that addition in any annual budget.
Thanks very much, and I think Ms. Kissel sort of explained it exactly true. These would be operational funds that we can do some things now to continue to enhance the delivery of security to our system. When you look at 3 years down the road, and that's the term of some of these grants, 36 months, we would be in a position to reevaluate our status as to manpower, personnel, things of that nature. And as we move into additional phases within our system, the decision can be made by the general manager at that time to consider that as an option, continuing that type of funding or to let it go, absorb it. We know that we will be losing people through attrition as well. And so those are some of the things that, given the opportunity that the federal government is giving transit agencies, and in particular WMATA, this opportunity, we would want to seize that opportunity to continue to deliver the level of security that we know that our people, both the patrons and the employees, deserve.
Mr. Costa, can I ask a follow-up? How many people are you anticipating hiring?
Roughly with this grant, I could say about 10.
About 10.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Downey had a question.
Chairman, on the capital grants from TSA, very happy to see this, but I think it adds to a substantial unobligated balance of grants that we've received in the past. And I don't know whether it would belong in this committee or in the security committee, but I would like to get a report on how those projects are going and what we can do to accelerate them.
Absolutely. We'd be more than prepared to give you that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Mr. Bolger.
I wouldn't.
Any other questions of the committee? If not, I'll entertain a motion to adopt the resolution before us. Moved by Mr. Dyke.
Second.
Second by Mr. Giancola. All in favor?
Aye.
The resolution passes.
Thank you.
Next up is an informational item regarding the capital and operating budget discussions, and we have Ms. Kissel or Mr. Green will be making today's presentation.
All right, I'm now on page 16 in your presentation packet. So this presentation is going to have three components to it. I will give you an update on the operating financial performance for the first half of the year. And then I will also update you on, I will come back to you. You had some questions at the last meeting we had related to the capital staffing costs, the Silver Line fare update, and the multi-year initiatives. In addition, we've got some information for you about the business planning initiative that we're undertaking. So the second quarter finance administration report was sent to you on February 3rd. You also received the January financial summary on February 11th, 11 days after the month-end close. We're making positive progress towards meeting our goal of an eight-day submittal on that plan. And we're committed to giving you more timely budget information, and also to our staff. They can use that information if they get it in a more timely manner. The 2013 budget discussion, as I said, you raised some specific issues, and we're going to address those in this presentation. The capital staffing costs, can you go back to the slide, please? The capital staffing costs, we're going to talk to you about the number of staff, the types of work performed, and we also have information about the makeup of the capital staff, and I've got Rob Troop here, and I've also got Jack Requa that are going to give you informational items on that. We've calculated the estimated impact of the GM's fare proposals you requested on the Silver Line, and you also asked us to show you the impact of the $35 million multi-year initiatives as well. Finally, there was a discussion about the more formal need for a business planning, and we need to take a longer view of financial planning. I want to let you know that we're going to report back to your committee next month with more information on multi-year financial planning, but we have begun to put in place this business planning process that will integrate into our budget development, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. First, let's talk about the fiscal year 12 first half budget performance. Our planned cost recovery ratios actually are better than budgeted for the year and for the quarter, excuse me, and year to date. We're favorable to budget by about $17 million or 5%. Year to date expenditures are favorable by 2.7% or $20 million, and the revenues are slightly off about 1% or $3.5 million under budget. Personnel costs are a negative, about $7.3 million, primarily due to overtime again. And we do have some initiatives in the 2013 budget that will help us with that. And materials and supplies are slightly over. And services were more favorable due to savings in paratransit and some delays in the ties and bus service contracts. We don't expect those underruns to continue, and we would expect that surplus to shrink slightly towards the end of the year. Year-to-date revenues, rail passenger fares are about $6.5 million below budget, and bus passenger revenue is favorable, and total other revenue is about $1.5 million below budget. Next slide, please. This chart, if you look at the heavy black line, that's the 2012 expenses. You can see a lot of volatility in expenses. We were here before you in the first quarter and explained that there were some costs that were miscorrectly being recorded in the capital program. You can see the higher expenses in the first quarter, and then you'll see a large dip in the second quarter. In the November timeframe, that's when that correction occurred. So we would anticipate that we would more closely track the budget from this point forward. Let me tell you briefly about our programs. Total expense on access year-to-date has been about $48 million. That's about $7 million or 12% under budget. And the cost recovery ratio for access during this first half of the year is about 8%, with an average trip cost of about $50. Total expense for rail was about $402 million, about 1% over budget, or about $4 million. Personnel costs, again, as we discussed earlier, were the primary driver. And again, we have those budget initiatives in 2013 to help address that. Cost recovery ratio for rail was very close to target, about 80%. Average trip cost of about $3.73. Our total expense for bus was $257 million. We're about $12 million or 6% under budget at this time, primarily due to a lag in some contractor payments. And again, we don't expect that underrun to continue for the rest of the year. Next slide.
Chairman,
oh, excuse me. Yes.
Mr. Eccles would like to ask a question.
You mentioned a moment ago a correction, a reporting correction regarding the actual capital expense for you. Could you just detail that a bit more, please? What the issue was, what was corrected, and what generated it?
Sure. There was some costs that should have been recorded in capital that were incorrectly recorded to the operating program in the early part of the year. Primarily equipment, parts, that type of thing. So in November, we took the accounting actions. We took some journal entries, made some journal entries to accounting corrections to get those over in the correct program. So we were over-reporting our capital and under-reporting our operating, the other way around, over-reporting capital. Yeah.
And what was the amount of the adjustment?
I beg your pardon?
What was the amount of the adjustment?
It was about $14.5 million.
Mr. Dean Cole also had a question.
Yeah, this is not the corrected chart, though, right?
This is the corrected
this
chart.
This is the corrected chart.
This actually shows the, you can see the, it's so volatile because of those actions. You can see that we
right, well, it seems to me that what you said, then, if we made the correction, it would have been a corrected chart, not showing the dip here. So I'm a little confused.
What I'm saying is this portrays the corrections. You can see that in November, we had we were under-expended by quite a bit, so there was some charges taken out of there. Sorry if I wasn't clear. The November actuals are reflecting a correction of about $14, $15 million. So it would have been higher if we hadn't made that correction. It's a credit.
Your charts are confusing.
Okay, sorry about that. All right, next one, please. Before I finish bus, the recovery ratio was about 28%, and the average cost per trip was about $3.90.
Mr. Costa. How did Metro Access compare? You said, can you give us both on the expense and the revenue side on Metro Access?
I'll give you the. Did you want me to?
Is it coming?
Yes.
Okay.
On the revenue side, Metro Access, and again, it's difficult for us to show Access on here, just a scale issue, but we'll resolve that for the next presentation. The year-to-date Access passenger revenue is about $3.9 million, which was about 29% higher than forecast, and the average fare paid was about $3.76.
Mr. Costa, and one of the things that we've been hearing really consistently, and I'm finding this myself very confusing, is that we have declining ridership on Access, and we have increasing revenue. And we're hearing from the disability community that they don't understand that either, and they feel like they're paying a lot more. This average fare that you just said sounds in the ballpark of where it used to be. So what I'm beginning to wonder is whether we have some kind of bimodal thing going on where we no longer have the middle trips being taken and we have a lot of short trips and a lot of really long trips, because we keep hearing about all these really long trips. And I'm not necessarily asking for an answer today, but this has got to get cleared up because people are totally confused about what's going on.
I think Kristen can address it quickly here. But
yes, Ms. Hines, you're quite correct. The average fare has increased over the previous year. One of the reasons why that was is because the fare policy that we have currently went into effect actually about a year ago this time. It was not in effect for the entire FY11, so it was implemented in the last quarter. Once that fare policy went into effect, wherever the customer's fare is comparable to a rail trip, that's where the fare is higher. What we're seeing is that about half of Metro Access customers are still paying the $3, the twice the bus fare. About 25% of them are paying the maximum fare of $7, and the remaining customers are paying somewhere in between.
Okay.
I guess what it says is the increased revenue is associated with the 25% of the riders who are now paying a $7 fare. And so if you compare our average fare last year to this year, it has gone up slightly, but it's still within an average fare of $3.60. That's more than last year, but it's in that range. It's the 25% that is feeling the maximum fare, and which is driving the revenue increase that you've seen here.
And the decrease in ridership was only like 1.7%, so it wasn't very large, but that hopefully helps to explain it.
In follow-on to that question, and you may have provided in the past, I've heard similar comments at the hearings, and you probably have already provided it, but if we could get a simple chart that kind of explains those changes in the fare and how those fares compare to our other base fares, it would be helpful to me and perhaps members of the disability community, but particularly as we look at working through this budget decision.
Okay. Because of the comments that we received in the public hearing, we're preparing a note to the board which will give you the entire picture, if you will, including that. So.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Mr. Acosta, can I?
Sorry.
Mr. Sarles, in this picture, and pictures are worth many, many words in my book. If there's any way to help us understand some of the geographic issues that are associated with these very long rides, and I don't know that it's possible, you know, in the world I live in, they can tell me my high fare people are all coming from this part of, you know, I have a huge concentration that comes from here and needs to get here. I don't know if when you look at the whole region, whether there are any patterns that tend to generate those ride at those prices very regularly.
That's generally not been the case, actually, because the fare is really more affected by whether or not that trip can be accomplished the fastest through rail versus bus. So it really has more to do with that than it does to do with the length of the trip. So there is not a direct proportionality to it in terms of trip length and price. It has more to do with that we are looking to the trip planner for the fastest equivalent smart trip fare and doubling it. And so whatever that faster equivalent is, when that comparable is rail, that's when the fare is higher.
So I'm sorry to belabor this, but let me pose then a question. Right now, people in the disability community know that if they can stay out of the peak, their fare is going to be the $3 fare or something equivalent, right? Or twice the rail fare, $3.60 or whatever,
if
right?
If they travel outside of the peak period, then they might be charged twice the off-peak rail fare.
Right.
So it's still bus
more
or rail.
It's still more, but it's the delta between the bus fare and the off-peak rail fare is not hugely significant.
It's less.
It may
That's
be
right.
significant for a person who's on a fixed income, but it's not like going to the peak rail fare.
That's correct.
So if we make the shift that we're talking about making of not having a flat off-peak fare on rail, have you all thought through what that's going to mean for this particular set of people? Because now they're going to be doing variable fare all day long, just at less of, you know what I'm saying? My question is not real good, but
I think I could respond this way. That certainly the community, the staff, the advisory committee are all aware that any changes that the board makes to the fixed route fare table will affect Metro Access. The two of them are indexed together. And certainly, you know, in preparing the proposed budget and assisting you with, you know, parsing through the material that's come in through the hearings and working with the general manager, we're continuing to do research on different impacts. So, you know, I mean, I'm guided by the general manager on that when he, you know, continues to have his discussions with you.
Also say, and I think I understand what you're asking. So what we're looking to do is model that impact, because presumably what you might have, and we haven't determined this yet, is you may have an increase of that 25% that's paying at that cap. You may have an increase of that. That's the outcome that we're looking to see, if that is happening or not, if the general manager's fare is included. So we'll have some of that modeling in the memo that we send, or some of the further analysis that we do on that. So.
But there's also an impact on the people who are currently paying between $3 and $7.
Yes, that's right. Right,
and to understand the perhaps the magnitude of what you're projecting, that in the dollar magnitude, because the increase you're showing is a function of all three of those.
It is.
Changing. So for us to understand that a little bit better, I think would actually be quite
helpful. So we'll just project
helpful.
What we think the shift may be
right.
of those, you know, average fare and the shift of who's paying the top, to who's reaching the cap, potentially. So.
Mr. Downs.
I have a hard time sorting out the differences between this variable fare and a capped or a flat fare for the system. As I understand it, 25% of the riders pay the max cap fare. The average fare is about $3.50, roughly. What is the price of having a max fare, flat fare, that is somewhere reflective of the revenue that is currently being generated by all of these variable guesstimators? I personally feel it would be helpful to understand the economics of a flat fare at a certain level versus the revenue stream that we've got here. The other is an understanding of what we're trying to impact by price elasticity here. We're trying to price a product to change behavior, I think, although I'm not sure. It would be helpful to understand what the pricing is supposed to accomplish from a standpoint of managing ridership and demand, but I don't know what that is, and it would be helpful for me at least to have that more clearly articulated. And the other is, are rides geocoded now?
Yes.
All rides?
Yes.
Origination and destination?
Yes.
Are geocoded so that the system can tell us where these rides are. You could map this.
Yes.
We had talked the other day, and I talked to Christian about this, and I think he can give you a quick answer as to, you know, where we can actually identify about two or three areas where there's a predominance of metro access, and that might be helpful in the bus stop.
Mr. Davis?
One other thing that has come up fairly frequently in the hearings is the issue of not knowing whether your trip will be classified as a peak trip or an off-peak trip. And, again, when you give us more information, it would be helpful to figure out how that can be dealt with. Yep.
Any other questions?
I'm on slide 20 now of your packets. Talk about ridership. Again, we'll adjust this chart next quarter to show the access ridership. But let me tell you about access ridership. Metro Access transported about 1 million passengers year to date, which is about 15% lower than the same period.
Can you speak into the microphone?
Sure. Thank you. We've carried about 1 million access trips so far this year, which is about 15% lower than budget. Ridership is down because, as Christian mentioned, board policies, eligibility, and travel training initiatives and their collective impact on the ridership. Due to travel training, we're seeing more of the community utilizing bus and rail options. On rail ridership, it continued to show signs of improvement and taking us the whole first half to get back to where we had hoped to be, but I think this is helpful to understand the revenue stream. In November, trips were up during all periods over the prior year. The largest increase occurred during the evening period. The year-to-date ridership is about 1% or 600,000 below projection, but actually within about 20,000 trips for the same period last year. Bus ridership continues to impress. It's about $5 million or 8% above budget and about $4 million or 7% above the same period from the prior year. Average weekday ridership has been strong, And in fact, this last month's, or December's positive performance was the 11th consecutive month where bus ridership exceeded expectations.
I will say that although this is the first half report, we do have and have provided January rail ridership numbers, and we had a significant month in January, as you know. They were up by 3%. So, you know, I think what's going to be happening, I'm not forecasting here at this moment, but, you know, we're going to sort of even out, and hopefully by the end of the year we'll be meeting our rail ridership budget projections, hopefully, and so that's a very good sign for January.
Thank you. I'm going to jump ahead to slide 22 now. We're now going to talk about the budget discussion. In our last meeting, you had some specific questions that you asked us to come back and address. The first of those questions had to do with capital staffing. We were proposing to add 255 capital staff. What this graphic depicts is the growth in the capital program in dollar terms over the last 7 years, 6 years. And you can see the dramatic growth in the last few years as we try to reverse that trend of underinvestment in the system. The labor costs, that white bar in the middle, or excuse me, the lower part of the chart, have stayed pretty constant at about somewhere in the range of about 15 to 20%. We're projecting them for 2013 to be about 18%. Consultant costs, these are the support we have for professional services, have stayed relatively constant. Again, about 5% is projected for next year. That translates to about $45 million. The majority and the overwhelming amount of growth has actually occurred in the top part of the graph, and that's rolling stock equipment and material purchases and the actual construction contracts themselves. We did some research and looked at other similar agencies. Capital delivery per FTE, not a perfect measure, but it was somewhat all over the board, and I know it's somewhat apples to oranges, but just for your information, our performance per FTE is about $1 million. That compares to SEPTA, Long Island Railroad, and MTA of about $500,000. And Truth in Lending, San Francisco BART is about $1.5 million. But again, there are tables. We've got some other information if you're interested. Next slide, please. This is a depiction of the total capital staffing that we're requesting for next year.
I'm sorry, one other question. I apologize.
No problem.
Related to the last slide, Metro labor costs associated with capital, that would be our capital procurement. Procurement and contract management costs associated with those contracts?
It's all the labor costs. Are you talking specifically about the labor?
But what is included in Metro labor costs on this chart?
The overwhelming majority of that, as you're going to see, is going to be the what we call our force account labor. Those are the men and women that are out on the railroad performing the labor. Those are the folks that are in our bus facilities that are doing the maintenance and rehab. There are administrative folks, and you'll see them on the next slide. There are some procurement people and other folks also included in there.
But most of the people are doing the construction. It's track work, signal work.
Okay, so they're
overhauling buses.
They're employees, but they're doing capital work.
Yes.
Okay.
And they're charging to the capital program.
Okay. Okay.
We'll get into quite a bit of detail about that. Next slide, please. So what this slide does is break out by those different functions the staffing required, and you can see that over 70% of the staffing is related to working on track and structures, facilities, and systems. That includes, this depiction does include the 255 that we're requesting, but this is the entire staff required. I'm going to hand it off now. You can see the work that, at the bottom of this slide, you can see the work that that we accomplish in our capital program using our force account and our internal staff. I'm going to hand it off now to Jack Requa. He's going to discuss our very successful bus rehabilitation program.
Mr. Downs had a question.
Sure.
Planning support and oversight.
Yes, sir.
Has that grown apace with the ramp up and the capital program? This year's misallocation of the capital, questions about the program's coordination and forecasting capacities. Is that an adequate number, and how has it grown? Has it grown proportional to the capital outlay and the budget over the last three fiscal years?
So we have grown it, and I would include the number above, so procurement. Because we had, you know, doubling our capital program, we actually added 24, what we call contract people in all entities, contracting officers, contracting managers, in order to support the scopes that need to be included and contracting capabilities. So we have increased that. As in terms of planning support and oversight, the only increase on that has been the decision that we made a year ago to move the planning function that plans out studies, looking at station management and things like that, that actually get incorporated into major projects. That was typically in our operating budget. So we actually made a movement, board approved, I think, last year, was to move that over into the capital area, because that's really where what the work was. It was in support of that capital program. Other than that, those are the only two changes that we have made so far. Have made no real oversight changes, other than we have actually included, I think Ms. Liu has included, four people to do more oversight in terms of audit compliance activities that the OIG would do. So that would be included in the oversight. But other than that, I'm sorry, yes, and we have some reporting, but that would be not employee.
No, but I'm saying that part of that oversight program manager on the board of PB to get moving fast.
Right, that would be outside of the employees, but that was the PB piece that we put in. That's correct.
Mr. Downs had another question.
We've all said that it's really important for all of us to be able to tell the story of the capital program. You're starting to do that with production criteria, the 15-year look back and look forward on critical elements within the program. That all takes brain power, it takes person head count. And if we're going to be aggressive about that kind of ability to explain ourselves to the public about $1 billion a year worth of capital program, the question is simply if you're all comfortable with the capacities of continuing to do that going forward. I see resource constraints about the ability to get that done in a timely fashion is all. I was not raising the question about whether or not there are too many people there.
Ms. Hines.
I really like this. This is actually really helpful. One of the questions I have, we're dealing with a maintenance backlog in Arlington, too, not nearly of the size of this, but we've come up with this notion of catch-up and then keep-up. And I always think of the people that we've hired internally that are permanent people on our staff as opposed to consultants or temporaries as the people that are necessary for me to do keep-up in the long run. So I can staff up with one-time money. I can contract to catch-up. But I want to get to stable keep-up. And the question I have for you here is, do you think this is close to keep-up? Is this about the level of staffing that we're likely to need for the next 5 years that we think should be built in, baked in to Metro, as opposed to the extra dollars we need to bring to close our gaps?
I'd like Rob Troop to talk about the rail side of that, because he's pretty much got that in his head.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. Rob Troop, Assistant General Manager, Trains Infrastructure Engineering Services. To answer your question there, I don't have the specific numbers on that, but what I will say is that specifically is what we're looking at as well, is the ability to bring in, you know, the balance between Metro personnel and consultants to be able to, like you said, to be able to keep up or, you know, maintain our steady state of maintenance. We have a workforce, you know, through attrition that's, you know, retiring and leaving. You know, we want to bring in the people through the capital program that will be able to supplement that workforce as they move out. So absolutely, that's one of the balances that we look at, you know, to be able to bring these people in. What's the long-term advantage of having these people in? You know, what's the short-term advantage of having, you know, certain Metro people in, you know, where we know we need ownership of that, of those specific projects, and then where do we bring consultants in? So it is one of the things we absolutely look at. In regards to this, you know, I mean, it's probably pretty close to a keep up. Like I said, we don't have the exact numbers vetted out on that, but it is one thing that we look at very, very closely.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Mr. Requa.
Thank you. The next, I want to speak to the bus rehabilitation program. There's always, every year, a number of questions in regards to this program, so I'd like to take an opportunity to try to address some of those. The budget line item is $30.9 million. And the first question is, it seems like that's an awful lot of money to put into 100 buses annually. And actually, that is not what this group does. This is 190 people that work in our heavy overhaul shop. They've been rebuilding parts, rebuilding buses since 1994. It's only moved to the capital program in the last couple of years. The actual cost for the overhaul program is about $125,000 per bus, and we do 100 buses a year, which equates to $12,500,000. These are similar programs that are at SEPTA, New York City Transit, and the MBTA in Boston. The components, we essentially redo electrical systems, engines, transmissions, pneumatic systems, wheelchair lifts or ramps, electrical components, and structural components at this point in time. Some people would say, well, why do you do a midlife overhaul? And I would say, the bus is going to run 500,000 or 600,000 miles over its life, and all of these things are going to have to be done at some point in time. We think it's more efficient to bring them in at the midlife and do them all at one time in a very efficient manner. Our staff is committed to and knows which kits to put in each model bus. It's all planned out ahead of time. So it's a very efficient process once it begins. Then there's a concern that we do the midlife overhaul because it extends the life of the bus, and that isn't true. And I just state the FDA circular that rolling stock overhauls are an eligible capital expense of preventative maintenance. Overhauls are usually done to make sure rolling stock reaches its useful life, and overhauls does not extend the useful life of the rolling stock. We think that our maintenance program over the years has proven that, from a cost-effectiveness standpoint, that the bus can last 15 years, and that we've extended that life and reduces the amount of funding that we require for replacement of buses, so we extend it 3 years. In addition to the overhaul program, we're also supporting the rest of the fleet. So there's 1,500 buses in the fleet. So we have $6 million for fleet improvement projects, cooling system, headlights, battery systems, pulley systems, everything else that works towards keeping the bus running. We spend about $4 million on engines and engine rebuilds and purchasing. Actually, one of our engines, the gas, natural gas engines, we found that it's not economical for us to rebuild those engines, so we contract that work out. We get a warranty and we get a lower cost and we can do it ourselves. $3 million on transmissions, $3 million on electrical components, and other small components we spend about $2 million. And that's how we get up to the $30.9 million. Others will ask, well, why don't you contract this work out? There's no firm within 500 miles of Washington that does this work. Recently, we received an unsolicited bid to rehab a bus, and it was $247,000. So we continually evaluate the components. We continually evaluate which things should be done in-house and out-house. And in this case, the 190 people that have worked on this project since 1994, I think we see as a stable level of workforce as long as the fleet stays about the same size and produces a good quality product. And we would think that this 190 people would continue into the future. We get asked questions about how do we compare with others from a maintenance standpoint. If I could, on page 32 in your in the appendix, we've done some comparisons with other systems. And just quickly, maintenance cost per mile, of the 10 major systems, we find ourselves second lowest, only beaten by New Jersey, but slightly. Maintenance expenditures per $1 million were the second lowest compared to a number of the systems. Miami-Dade is the one that's lower than us. Average maintenance costs per bus were kind of in the middle of the group. And an interesting one on page 33, bus to mechanic ratio. We have 2.3 buses for each mechanic, we have the highest number of buses per mechanic than any of the other systems that we compared to. So we think from a comparative standpoint that we watch our cost and we try to provide an efficient system. And I think from a mean distance between failures, even though everybody measures it differently, I think we're up over 7,100 miles this fiscal year. And we think that we rate rather well against the other systems, even though usually the comparisons are apples to oranges. So with those comparisons, and hopefully we'd be happy to answer any other questions on the rehabilitation program.
Are there any questions for Mr. Requa? Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, thank you for the report. Some future date, I'd like to get an update, and I know we did this a year or so ago, on the types of fuel that we use in the engines, whether they're hybrid or diesel hybrid and such. I'd like to get an update on how many in the fleet are in each of the categories of types of fuel we use, as well as any kinds of issues we have with certain types of bus engines. So.
Yes, in the vital signs report, there is the mean distance between failures for each of the fleets. Obviously, we're in a procurement mode of buying hybrid buses. We have 460 CNG buses. I think they're running around 8,000 miles. I'd have to go look at the next committee meeting charts to make sure. The hybrids still are performing at a higher level. Remember, CNG buses we haven't purchased for a while. I think the hybrids up around 9,000. Clean diesel were buses we bought in 2005, and then there are the older buses. And I think the combination of the board supporting the rehabilitation program and the bus procurement program, that is how we are successfully moving up the mean distance between failures. Some of the issues, one of the issues we had last summer when the temperatures got over 95 or 100, we did have some trouble with the hybrid buses. It was an engine issue. We have the manufacturer in here, and we expect everything to be adjusted and refitted to be ready by April for the summer season, so we don't anticipate any HVAC issues. There's always little things. We've got a lot of campaigns going on. I'd be happy to provide you a long report as to everything that's going on that's provided by maintenance.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Requa? Not? Proceed.
I'd like to hand it over to Mr. Troop now, please.
Thank you.
If you would just go ahead. Go ahead.
I thought the best thing, so that you could understand sort of how we involve our contractors and our force account personnel, was sort of take you through what our planning process is. The chart that you see up here is our revenue service adjustment chart. It's our track usage chart that includes single tracking events and where we have buses replacing trains and also our early outs. You can see this is a fairly complicated chart. It's less complicated. It's less complicated now because we are moving into the Cherry Blossom Festival. So you actually are seeing a lot of white space here, which I'm sure you're looking forward to. But what I'd like to do is speak specifically on the March 18th shutdown, which will be Shady Grove to Rockville. What we have, I'm sorry.
Just for clarification purposes, could you go back to the chart before, please? And just share with us what the chart is tracking and what it yields in terms of benefit and how it helps us. Just spend a moment on it, please. It's hard to read, but if you could describe what it says.
Certainly. What you're looking at here is, you know, what is our revenue service adjustments. Like I said, for those items that would be include single tracking events, early out single tracking events, and also the where we have the buses replace trains. This is a tool that we utilize through our planning efforts to make sure, you know, that we don't have any conflicts in our track usage and to maximize those work efforts to be able to put the maximum amount of work into a single area that we can. All the stations where the single trackings are done, it defines the length of the work area. Through the shutdown, it defines what the length of the work area is there. And it defines what the schedule adjustments will be for the operations personnel, for the construction personnel. They can plan their work out, like I said, based on the geographic regions on that. And it also decides who the owner of the work is. In other words, the primary owner of that specific shutdown or that specific single tracking event, so that that work is prioritized. We meet weekly on this. This is a dynamic chart, you know, and we do make changes to this periodically. We try to establish this 8 weeks out, and again, you know, this is the planning tool that we utilize for our revenue service adjustments.
Okay. Is that? Thank you. Yes, the point of my question was just to try to draw out how you use the tool in terms of how it benefits the system, and because we can't read it.
Right.
So
right.
What is
right.
What's the? Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
If there are no objections, as I mentioned earlier, we have a guest who is going to address the board, and I'd like to turn over the meeting to Mr. Downey, who will make the introductions.
Thank you, Mr. Costa. It's really our privilege to have with us this morning John Pistol, who is the 5th Transportation Security Administrator, and really working hard on issues that we all are concerned with, and really a great partner. We had an earlier board action this morning to accept your money. But even more than that, the advice and the support that you've given, it's a major challenge for all of us. I'm particularly pleased that transit security is on your personal agenda, along with all the other things. I note in your bio, and Administrator Pistol had a long career with the FBI, but one of the things he did was involvement in stopping the plot against the New York City subways, whom I used to work for, and we really appreciate that. So we're very happy to have you here this morning, and whatever you want to say, if you want to use the podium, whatever, we're pleased to have you here.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Moore, for that introduction. The reason I'm here today as the TSA administrator is really a couple of basic reasons. One is to say thank you to WMATA, to the board, for what you do, representing the men and women of WMATA, and what they do every day, day in and day out, to help keep the people of the D.C. metro area safe and secure as they travel. And it's, and particularly, to thank General Manager and CEO Rich Charles and Police Chief Mike Taborn for their leadership in terms of a partnership with TSA and how we can best work together in collaboration to ensure that what WMATA does and what TSA does is well blended and well organized. And when I think about the police and what they do and what the board and your oversight role is, you know, the board can have the greatest policies, protocols, and procedures in place, but without a great police force to execute on those items, then there's still vulnerabilities there for you and for us, for all riders. And so what we try to do is work at it from the standpoint of knowing that the best opportunity to prevent a terrorist attack is almost always by the frontline operators and the officers informed by the latest intelligence. We try to make sure that there is robust intelligence sharing. And then we also do things because we also recognize, and I know from my FBI days, that rarely do we have that kind of specific, credible, timely intelligence that says there's going to be an attack, you know, on a metro system or on a bus, as we've seen worldwide, not only the last 10 years, but for decades. And so what we try to do is partner in terms of things like random and unpredictable activity, such as the Viper teams, the Visible Intermodal Protection Response teams. And last year in partnership, we did over 175 of those Viper team operations, which again serve as a deterrent to those possible terrorists who we know from our experience are deterred by really three things, visible police force, canines, and CCTV. And so WMATA does a great job, in the police under Chief Taborn does a great job in that respect. So the second and the particular reason I'm here today is to recognize WMATA on achieving what we call in TSA the Gold Standard Award for your excellence in 17 different categories of a what we call a BASE assessment, and BASE is B-A-S-E, Baseline Assessment for Security Enhancements. So it's our job in TSA, obviously, to work with you in a way that, that makes sense. And I'm glad to hear you accepted some of our money. That's always a good thing. As you are very aware, but over since 2005, WMATA has been awarded nearly $113 million in transportation security grant funds from TSA. And that's in recognition of you as a frontline operators and those responsible for the day-to-day security and safety of the, what, over a million passengers that WMATA carries, both on metro and on buses. And so, General Manager and CEO Sarles, if you would come up, I have this plaque I'd like to present. There's no big check with it or anything this time, but But at least it's a recognition of symbolism of our friendship, our appreciation for what you do every day. So thank you very much.
And on behalf of all the men and women of WMATA, and especially the police department, we accept this, but most especially we appreciate the long-term cooperation and collaboration that we've had with your department, and we look forward to that continuing in the future.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, we'll resume our meeting, and again, thank you to the staff at WMATA for winning this wonderful award from TSA. Okay, we're going to resume our discussion about scheduling track work, and I believe you may continue your discussion, your presentation.
Thank you. I said one of the things that we look at is who the primary owner of the track shutdown is. If we look specifically at March 18th shutdown that's coming up, what we've done is we made a determination that the track circuit, the NTSB track circuit replacements, are the primary owner of that. Once we look at that, we make a determination of what the size of the work zone is and how we can coordinate work efforts within that work zone. Once we make that determination and also prioritize the work efforts that are in there, whether it be, you know, within a certain geographic area, whether it be fasteners or ties or rail that we have to do or welds, we make a determination based on prioritization and geographic size how we're going to do that work. Very often, almost all of the track work is done with WMATA force account personnel. Whether that be fasteners or tires or rails. We do that with WMATA force account personnel. The exception to that is flash butt welding, which is always contractor work. So, you know, we say, okay, we're going to go in and we're going to do contractor work with the flash butt welding. We're going to bring them in. We're going to bring our WMATA force account personnel. We're going to bring, the tie gang, the tie production gang in there, or we're going to do fastener work. So you can see there's a lot of moving elements to this work that we look at. There's a lot of moving parts to this which need to be coordinated on this. Sometimes we'll look at the size of the geographic area. We'll make a determination whether or not we can bring in a contractor tie unit to help supplement our own force account personnel. Remember, we're working in a limited geographic area, so it's important that, you know, these elements of work are not on top of each other so that we can maximize efficiency. But always when we do a single tracking event or when we do a shutdown event, we try to maximize that work effort within that work zone. If we could look at the last shutdown, which was previously completed on the chart, I don't think it's in their packet, Bill. Do they have the?
Yeah, thank you. There was a Chair Acosta, you asked us to come back and maybe discuss some of the span of control, kind of give you a breakdown of what this staffing would look like. So we created a couple of graphics. They're not in your packet, but we'd like to show them to you now.
So from our this just kind of gives you an idea of the amount of work that we have going on and the type of work efforts that we have. See, the frontline workers, we have 285 frontline workers. This will include the force account personnel engaged in actively doing the track work. It's the inspectors that are inspecting the track circuit work that's being accomplished by the contractors. There's engineers and mechanics that are involved in that work as well. For this specific shutdown, like I said, we had 285 people working, actively engaged in work. We have working supervisors who are on the right of way. They're actively engaged in the work. And 14 management personnel overseeing the coordination of the work efforts. Also within this work effort, we had about 30 to 50 contractor personnel per shift engaged in these work activities. primarily performing track circuit replacement, but also doing flash butt welding as well. So there's like I said, we bring in a number of people. Our determination of whether we utilize force account or contractor personnel is primarily based on geographic regions, priority of work, and maximizing the work effort within those regions.
Thank you, Rob. If we could, we'd like to also go back to the bus. We've got we prepared a similar slide for the bus, and Mr. Requa.
Yeah, just a comment here. Again, the 190 people that we talked about earlier in the bus maintenance staffing program on the capital side, almost all are mechanics or technicians that are doing the rebuilding work and the installation work. There are 10 supervisors that monitor the different work at the two different facilities and 4 management people that will just oversee it, make sure the numbers are correct, and do their appropriate accounting for this project.
I love these. These are really cool. I think you need to show the contractors as little people, but a different color. If you do it again, it will give the right message that's the additional support you brought in. It's a little confusing with that. This is the input side, right? And this communicates very well that there's a whole bunch of people down there working. What we need is a graphic on the output side that says when the customer, when we send the alert out or whatever, you know, the dome of the thing is got a red line saying there's something going to be changed, the dome of the station. We're changing the lighting. We're fixing the floor. You need a similar graphic that helps to convey to people that all these people being there means all these things are better. Because that's the conversation, I think we were talking before the meeting, that's the conversation we're all having trouble with when we talk to the public. Some of it is noticeable. The lights, changing out the lights is incredibly noticeable, and people are really appreciative. But a lot of this other stuff, we are not able to communicate it well, and which means we don't have the right tools. These graphics are getting us so much closer. So if we could maybe have some thinking on the output piece, that could really help us all.
Mr. Diani?
Yeah, I just want to note in the appendix to this month's report, there is for the first time some really good data about production, what's expected to get done, what is getting done. It's a great step forward. I agree with Ms. Hines. We can find better ways to even display it. But at least it's now here for people to look at, and it's pretty impressive. Thank you.
Okay, you also asked us to come back to you and portray the impacts of the GM's proposed fare increase on the Silver Line service. What this chart shows us is that the total ridership is going to be relatively small. It's about 1.4%. We think that in 2014, with 6 months of service, we're going to generate about an additional $1.1 million revenues once we layer the GM's package across this. And the fare box recovery significantly, if you look at the bottom, is going to go up about 7%. In 2015, you, in effect, double that. We'll be under a full year of service for the first time, and we should generate about a little over $2 million in revenue. Again, a healthy gain in the fare box recovery. And I just want to be clear that the fare box recovery only deals with fares in this case.
Mr. Downey had a question.
Yeah, I think this got misreported this morning as that the Silver Line will bring in $1.1 million versus $1.1 million is the increment that the fare increase will produce. It will actually be bringing in $14.8 million in a half year or $30 million in a full year.
Thank you for that clarification, yes.
Next slide. Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, looking at the chart at the very bottom, fare box recovery, am I reading that wrong? It says the original estimate was 35, the GM proposal is 37. They show a 7% variance. Where did that number come from?
2 percentage points, but 2 percentage points on a base of 35 represents a 7% increase.
Okay. All right.
Likewise, with the 66 to 7, it's 5 percentage point increase, but on a base of 66, it's a 7%.
Thank you.
Thank you. You also asked for a multi-year look at the initiatives that we have, the $35 million initiatives. And you can see that our request for 2013 is $35 million, and that grows to 44.8 in 14 and almost $47 million in 15. The primary driver is the system improvements, and this is driven by additional bus service for the most part.
Mr. Acosta.
Ms. Hines?
I want to be sure I understand this. This is brand new money every single year. So I have to add $44.8 million in 2014?
I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. There'll be an incremental cost of about $9 million as you go into 2014, and an incremental cost of about another $2 million on the base.
That's really helpful, because when I looked at this in the beginning, my breath was taken away. It's not clear. If you had a last column that said change from 2013 to 2014, it might then communicate my step up is.
Thank you for the suggestion. It will portray it more clearly next time. Thank you. Next. And finally, you asked us to get back to you and start thinking more in a long term, in both our business planning and also in our financial planning. As I mentioned earlier, we'll be back to you next month with more long-looking financial information, the impacts of these initiatives on our programs in a four-year look. We already have that in capital, but we'll bring in the operating, and we'll also show the interconnectivity between the two programs. What this shows is a business planning process that we're going to embark on for the next budget process. We're perfecting it, but it's also very important before we get started to note that these steps are not sequential necessarily, they often overlap. So our goal is to connect the strategic plan and goal plans with operations and capital through implementation strategies, to integrate budgeting and performance management, and promote collaboration between agencies and encourage system thinking, thinking across our various divisions. We'll use evidence and data to analyze and recommend alternatives, and we'll provide a standard format and methodology for analysis and discussions. The business planning process guides and informs our budget requests and actually links that budget request to the strategic plan and the strategic thinking. So this will help provide key information for the GM's decision-making process around resource allocation by clearly articulating agency goals, existing policy framework and change drivers, and program prioritization criteria. And it will align our programs with the services to the objectives contained in the board's strategic plan.
Mr. Downs.
I want to applaud everybody for pushing ahead both the strategic plan and the business plan. For a lot of what we heard in this round of hearings about the fare increase, people don't understand. It's overstating the obvious. Customers don't understand what's happening and why there is so much inconvenience in the system, because we have not actually been able to create an outcome plan, an explainable story going forward about where all of this is taking us, what the capital program is buying, what the targets are. And I would encourage you to think about this at the business plan as having a primary function of being a communications tool with our customers, explaining where the next 2 to 4 years are going with capital and operating, the key performance indicators, the safety, dependability, reliability targets going forward over the next 2 to 4 years, all of the accomplishments that are embedded in the capital budget be made visible so that they can tell a story. It's a communications tool, primarily, and while it has a lot of functions as a business plan internally, I think this is what we're lacking about the ability to tell our story coherently, consistently with the public about our future. So.
Any other questions for Mr. Green? If not, we'll move on to the next item, which is a quarterly report on capital progress. Mr. Truth.
Thank you. Again, Rob Troop, Assistant General Manager, TIES. I'm pleased to present the second quarter report for fiscal year 2012 for the capital budget and program. Next slide, please. Because our investment dollars are directly relational to our ability to create a better transportation experience for our customers, I would like to begin my report by presenting the second quarter investments to date for the capital improvement program and our forecasted spend rate. As indicated on the graphic, the second quarter investment is $307 million, which is approximately 35% of the forecasted annual amount of $917 million, which is the billing amount to the jurisdictions. Our current projections, which are provided by the individual project managers and updated every quarter, have been revised to $805 million. Our expectation is that we will spend $805 million this year. There are several reasons for the reduced investment, but the major issues deal with underexpending the forecasted amounts for Southern Bus Garage and Cinderbed Garage, and other which I will detail later in the presentation. Our track geometry vehicle was forecasted to be expended this fiscal year, and while it is on delivery schedule, the expenditure may not take place until next fiscal year. We are pleased, however, that the Orange Blue Line rehabilitation project is underway and will increase our investment potential over last year. In addition, we are moving forward phases of the Red Line to take advantage of our station closures. Next slide. What is more important than our spend rate, however, is the work that is being accomplished to improve our regional transportation system. The Capital Improvement Program, or CIP, consists of over 130 separate projects. Some of these projects are standalone, but most of the projects are interconnected in some manner, with many being codependent projects. As indicated here, we have major subdivisions of work disciplines, such as vehicles, rail line contracts, systems and technology, and track and structures. In addition, we have the ARRA funding, which contributes to some of the capital projects, such as the Red Line contract, and also our safety and security initiatives. Now, speaking on the safety and security initiatives, I'm very excited about the Network Electronic Safety and Security Project, which is an enterprise-wide approach to security, which includes development of a strategic operations command center. For this project, we have made awards to three different contractors to help accelerate work efforts and take advantage of the grants. And we will be installing cameras in the latter part of this month. These will be digital high-resolution cameras and provide better identification of incidents within the rail network. Next slide. How fast we expend the budget or how quickly we can put people in place to do the work is only important if we deliver on our promise to reinvest in the system. As I mentioned earlier, the capital program is truly comprehensive and impacts all portions of the transportation network. While I'm not going to review all 130 projects, I would like to give an overview of some of the projects, their status, to be able to give you an idea of the breadth of the program. One of our more important programs is the replacement of buses. Our plan to have 151 new buses in fiscal year 12 is well on schedule, so much so that through the second quarter we delivered 94 of that 151. Through effective project management, we were able to identify unexpended funds and will have delivered to the authority an extra 15 buses by the end of fiscal year 12, bringing the total to 166. Also included in the 151 are five hybrid buses that are part of an FTA pilot program. While these buses do have a diesel engine, it exclusively charges a battery bank, and all of the wheel drives are through traction motors. And these should be proved to be more efficient in both fuel consumption and maintenance. So we're looking forward to working with those.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question.
Yes, Mr. Nichol.
These buses represent what percentage of our fleet and what percent do we typically want to be able to move through this rehabilitation process cycle, and how are we doing in that regard to the overall fleet?
Jack Requa, let me try to answer. We have 1,500 buses. We try to keep the bus 15 years, so we'd like to replace the buses 100 per year, which is essentially what the capital program is doing. There's some advancement in FY12, and we'll see a reduction in FY13 to keep that 100 bus per year process. The other rehabilitation program, which we talked about earlier, rehabilitates 100 buses per year, so we're on target. These are all replacement buses that, well, the last 15, some of those buses are for additional service, but generally these are all replacement buses, replacing buses that have operated for 15 years with 500,000 miles plus on each one.
Not for extensive discussion at this moment, but the allocation of new buses to throughout the system, how does that happen?
Well, we're trying to allocate the buses on a average age basis for all three jurisdictions. We have some restrictions at some facilities due to age that we cannot put new buses in. For example, Royal Street, the newest bus we can put there is 10 years old. We're hoping to move forward with the replacement program. But essentially, we're looking at balancing the age of the fleet across the jurisdictions. And with the completion of Shepherd Parkway and the addition of compressed natural gas, you know, we'll be able to keep that in a balanced mode. So I think we're very sensitive to trying to keep the average age equal in the three major jurisdictions.
Well, next slide, please. Thank you. Obviously, we not only procure the new buses, but doing capital overhauls to the existing fleet, which Jack had mentioned. As indicated, we're on schedule and budget to complete the 100 rehabs by the end of fiscal year 12. The rehabilitation is a capital investment in our existing fleet, extending not only the serviceable life of the bus, but also the reliability and efficiency of the component. And I just want to note again that this program is not just a midlife overhaul, but capitalizes replacement of other components, such as transmissions, and which Mr. Requa had mentioned earlier.
I just want to add one thing. When you see a rehabilitated bus, it's a new bus. It's got the new paint job, everything else. You wouldn't know the difference.
The introduction of the new 7000 series rail car is progressing, and we are very, very pleased with the development of this car. While there has been a five-month schedule impact due to the tsunami in Japan, we continue to work diligently with Kawasaki and have a truly world-class car that will help our Silver Line expansion and management of our current service. Hard mock-ups have been built and are being reviewed. I've seen the progress on this vehicle and the technology that's being put into it, and I know that it will be a welcome addition to our fleet capabilities. The project stays within budget. Next slide. Our line contracts are significant programs in themselves, with rehabilitation of numerous elements, including kiosks, platforms, emergency trip stations, elevators, escalators, vent fans, automatic train control, HVAC, and also ceiling tile improvements. Platform rehabilitation is one of the most significant elements of the line contracts. Because the contractor requires so much access to the platform edge, we require many single tracking efforts and shutdowns to complete the work. Our original intent was to redo about one-third of the surface area of the selected platforms. This was determined through inspections prior to developing the contract proposals. However, once work began, we saw an accelerated deterioration of concrete and decided to undergo total platform rehabilitation efforts to minimize repeat repair and also repeat rail disruption. So while our cost per platform has increased as compared to the base, our price per unit, in this case square footage, has remained the same. Escalator and elevator performance is a high priority for us, and our work efforts are focused toward that end. The line contracts give us an opportunity to rehabilitate or replace escalators, and we have seen successes at Foggy Bottom and Union Station. Our work continues, most notably at DuPont Circle, and we are monitoring the progress there very closely. The line contracts, in addition to CIP 72 and 73, provide for the rehabilitation replacement of escalators and elevators. Specific to the Red Line contract, you can see we have invested $11 million and our production units to cost is on target for the work plan for FY12. Simply put, halfway through the year, we have invested half our Red Line escalator budget and produced half of our planned replacement and rehabilitations. Next slide.
Chairman, I'm sorry. One question. Mm-hmm. In terms of the, just more, again, a context question, mm-hmm. This is what we've accomplished, but what is there remaining to be done? So we've done this much. How much is still to be done to get us to that state of good repair? To create, how much progress are we making?
There's a significant amount of obviously there's work to be done. There's no question about that. We started work on escalators at Roslyn, DuPont, Eastern Market, Potomac, Union Station, Judy Square, Metro Center, Federal Center, Gallery Place, Chinatown, Huntington, and Arlington Cemetery as some of the Metro Rail stations. So this is a, you know, we do have a six-year CIP program, and we're trying to do some reprogramming efforts so that we'll be able to do some escalator replacements instead of rehabilitations, which we think will be significantly more cost-effective. Those numbers specifically, we can be able to get to you, you know, the plan moving forward, what those numbers are. Unfortunately, I don't have specifically, like I said, those numbers here with what we need to accomplish, but
I guess the only yeah. This is good, very good data, and it's good to know that we're on track. I think that to the point of Mr. Down's question a little earlier, I think we need to take every opportunity that we can to constantly create a context for what we're presenting to demonstrate how much progress we're making against the overall goal or not, mm-hmm. and that would help people to understand what we're investing, why we're investing it, what is yet to be invested to get our customers to a place of the kind of service that we all know we want and are striving toward.
I think we could probably produce a graphic along those lines. Thank you.
And I think we should do that for every one of these.
With some of the high.
Right. Whether it be replacing platforms, whether it be replacing buses, replacing escalators. It's just a little bit more data, but it has a powerful impact on what we are trying to accomplish.
Very good.
Mr. Bulger had a question.
Yeah, I wanted to know on the escalators, have we kicked in the competition with the private sector escalator contractors versus in-house escalator workers?
The quick answer is we've got the proposals in. We're evaluating them. When we get done with that, we'll award the contract.
Okay. Will you let us know when the competition begins? Or okay. All right. I didn't mean awarding, Rich, of the competition contract. I meant when we actually start seeing metrics that says we're getting escalators done faster with private sector escalator versus in-house escalator workers. Okay. Follow-up, Chairman. I noticed we got the Rich gave us an update on the 7,000 series. How about the 5,000 series, which had, you know, so many problems a couple meetings? Are we? I think I asked David. What, all right. All right. Well, I'll wait.
Thank you. The National Transportation Safety Board has made specific recommendations to replace the Alston Generation 2 track circuits. And this is a project that has been awarded to Ansaldo and work progressing first on the red line. The replacement of these track circuits is the first step in being able to go back to automatic train operation. There are two components to this work, the replacement of the module, which is located within the train control room and is basically the smart side of the system, and the replacement of the bond, which is wayside in picture here. This is a mini bond, and it's tuned to the specific frequencies for the specific track circuit section that detects the presence of the train. The bond here, as you can see, requires total access to the track. This is one of the reasons that we take the single tracking events and the shutdowns. And it also requires access to not only install the bond, but also to test the track circuit itself. The installation of the bonds and modules is on schedule thanks to the grouping of shutdowns that we have that are occurring here in March. This is an important component ensuring the safety and reliability of the ATC system. A major component of our investment is the rehabilitation of the right-of-way. This includes major track fixtures such as ties, fasteners, rails, and turnouts. As can be seen in the chart, our investment through the second quarter is approximately half the budget. However, in all circumstances, current trending and production counts indicate we will exceed our planned annual totals. This can be attributed to the single tracking events and shutdowns, which create better opportunities for increased production efficiencies because we are lessening our mobilization and demobilization impacts, as well as providing continuous assembly line approaches to the work efforts. In all instances, our production rates will be higher than those over the previous last fiscal year. In addition, the procurement of new and specialized equipment gives us higher production rates. We have now have the right tools for the right job. Also, one of the most important elements is the planning and the execution of the work by the transit professionals who are engaged in the production efforts. We have been continually developing personnel in-house, WMATA personnel who know and understand the tasks which are required and can perform those tasks in a difficult environment. I cannot overstate the importance that these people have in achieving the required production levels to reduce backlog and enable us to achieve the steady state requirements, ensuring efficient and reliable service. We recognize what these outages mean to our passengers. We work to maximize our production in a multifaceted approach through better planning, better tools, and developing a highly skilled workforce. I spoke about equipment. The tie exchange machine increases production levels for tie replacement so that we'll be achieving over 20,000 ties replaced per year. What this machine does, it extracts the tie, and it can do so approximately a minute to a minute and a half less than what we currently have available to us.
Mr. Bulger had a question,
oh, I'm sorry.
And also Mr. Downey.
Question on
Mr. Bulger asked us.
You were going to explain all this engineering, but I want to go back to the question. All these wonderful pieces of equipment, did we ever have any of these before and now we got them? Or is this like we were without this equipment and now we had to get it?
Some of the items, like the tie exchange machine, we did not have that.
Where's the tie machine? What's that?
The tie exchange machine. That's the unit up, yeah. And, oh. And what that does is, like I said, that extracts the tie yeah. very quickly in one
What did we
swoop.
Do before? We had tie hammers.
We had tie cranes, what I call a tie handler. And what you have to do there is you have to make four or five picks mm-hmm. with that tie handler. Yeah. So, you know, when you're looking at 20,000 ties and decreasing that by, you know, a minute and a half to 2 minutes, mm-hmm. you know, it makes a significant, oh, yeah. significant amount of time in there. Items such as the tamper, we may have had lower production tampers. We had tampers, but they were lower production. Mm-hmm. Additionally, one of the items, this is higher technology as well. It's all GIS-related, GPS-related, you know, it has the lasers on it that we can be able to do high-production tamping to be able to do it a lot quicker. Like a ballast regulator, we've had ballast regulators before. This is just, you know, recapitalizing that equipment. That's
What's
correct.
A Geismar? Yeah. Is that
the Geismar 360 is exactly what it says. It's a crane that can turn into 360.
Oh.
That's important in our tunnel work to be able to, so that we don't have to utilize, go back and forth with switching. Significantly, so we can. So the Garden Number 8s, the production that we're getting in that, a lot of that is relatable to the Geismar 360.
That's Mr. Kubicek's favorite piece of equipment.
Just an observation. If we can continue this rate of production, which is really running ahead of plan, is there a time at which there obviously some time when we'll be back to a normal steady state of good repair? Is this an indication that maybe that's sooner than we otherwise would have been?
We are vetting through those numbers right now.
Yeah.
One of the items is, and I'll present this a little bit later in the presentation, is about the fasteners. The challenges we have with certain types of stuff that we're doing. So we're comfortable that with the ties we can achieve the steady state of production and also reduce the backlogs as well.
Ms. Hutchins?
I was just going to say that I think we probably need the link that you provided us earlier on the YouTube, because it's a fascinating piece to watch. You could get hooked to it. But it does tell the story, and it's a very graphic way of getting.
At the hearing the other night, they had the video
yes.
of the tie machine.
Yes, the tie, just, yeah. Yeah, I think we need to see the link and keep telling the public about it.
Getting rid of the backlog of ties was our best estimate today, you know, reflecting this production. But as our folks get more and more efficient with it, we may be able to revise that estimate. That showed us getting to a steady state about 2017 or 18, right? And if we can improve on that, we will.
If we go to the next slide, please. This is our track geometry vehicle, and this is currently in Letterkenny, Pennsylvania, where it's being outfitted with electronics that will be utilized to analyze the geometry of the track. This includes gauge, vertical, and horizontal profiles, as well as sounding of the rail for potential defects. The sounding gives us the advantage of identifying rail cracks or even the potential of rail cracks before they become out of spec. The unit is extremely advanced. It also has infrared imaging, which will help in identifying loose connections for track circuits and also traction return. Clearance items are also shown, and we can trend movement of items which may be slowly encroaching on the right-of-way. This enables us to take care of issues before they have impact to the operations. What the TGV gives us is the ability to program work more efficiently, as we have a better baseline of the track structure and can measure more accurately trending of defect or deterioration. We can hit those spots that need it more quickly and efficiently. If the board has not already taken a site visit, I would recommend going out and visiting Shepherd Parkway Bus Garage. This is truly a world-class bus maintenance facility and will be able to expand as the needs of the bus service grow. This was built as a Silver LEED certified building, and it's not only environmentally efficient, but the workflow processes will create efficiency in how we maintain our bus fleet. The facility will also have compressed natural gas delivery to service our CNG fleet. And we're excited to having this facility nearing completion and expect to have people there maintaining buses in late 2012.
Mr. Downs.
Do you have an updated cost to complete?
I can provide that to you. Okay. The cost to complete is slightly under. We do have projections. Right now, we don't have the exact numbers for the utility cost, the utility impact, but we do know that it will become slightly under budget. That's correct. Some of the highlights for summer 2012. As we move the capital program forward, we're very pleased that the guarded number 8 turnouts will be completed in June of 2012. This was an NTSB recommendation, and this was completed within the budget and the scheduled time frame, and was completed by WMATA Metro Force account personnel. Station enhancement work continues, and this is similar to detailing on the cars we have on your car. We have aggressive cleaning that goes on, lighting, some painting is performed at each location, and work for the summer includes Largo Town Center and King Street stations. Our work on White Flint and Twin Brook will resume. Earlier we had completed the granite edging and platforms, and where we returned to replace the paver tiles. Examples of the type of tile we are using can be found at Shady Grove and Rockville. We begin the rehabilitation work at Western Bus Garage. This is a 67-year-old facility, and this will include significant improvements to power, storage tanks, and major repairs to the facility.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. One of the main things we hear in the summer is about air conditioning in the stations, and I would just appreciate an update at some point before we get to the hot season about what our game plan is on air conditioning.
I probably can't run through right now. Yeah.
Just something in writing.
Memory gets, as I get older, the memory gets.
Welcome to the club. So,
but we can provide that. That shouldn't be a problem. We do have some impacts to our schedule, which affect our ability to invest in the system. I believe the board is aware of the current lawsuit against Cinderbed, which has delayed moving forward into construction. We expect the issue to be settled by October of 2012, and we are currently organizing our contract to that end. The Southern Bus Garage selection has been delayed due to local governmental considerations, and we hope to have a final decision on this issue maybe within 2 months. The tsunami has created delivery issues with Kawasaki and their suppliers, and this has created a 5-month delay in project delivery. For Orange Blue Line, we were delayed in executing the NTP because we wanted to apply certain lessons learned from the Red Line prior to providing the award, some of which included the ability to move phases forward and also exceptions that the contractor was taking with the contract. Our narrow banding project has been delayed as well, Mr. as a result of the passing of House.
Mr. Giancarlo had a question.
Get back to the 7,000 series rail cars. 5-month delay, you said. How does that impact on our opening date for the Silver Line right now? Or does it?
We'll use the existing fleet to help opening day. This is
the you'll use the existing fleet of rail cars to implement that.
Yep. Start out anyhow. And this is the same announcement we had made a few months ago about the delay. It's not additional.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Like I said, the passing of House Resolution 3630 may require, we're not entirely sure, but it may require to give us, for us to give up our current 490 megahertz radio frequency and move to a 700 to a 800 megahertz radio frequency. The reason this delays us is because under the original narrowband scope, we would not have been required to replace anything in the underground. However, if we have to go to a different frequency, we will have to replace items in the underground, so we wanted to do it all as one contract. So, you know, this has put us behind. As we vet through these issues with the FCC and looking at exceptions on this, we'll know better, you know, exactly what the impact is there. This chart should look somewhat familiar to you. But instead of our successes with ties, I wanted to focus on what some of our challenges were with the fastener installation. Fasteners are the cradle that the rail sits in our direct fixation, which is in our tunnel areas and our viaduct and bridge areas. It's suspect to corrosion. There's a lot of corrosion that occurs on these. And in order to have a steady state, we need to be doing about 20,000 of these per year. We have over 500,000 fasteners within the system. We have a backlog now of 150,000 fasteners which need to be replaced. We should be accelerating our work production to about 75,000 fasteners per year. We're about 15,000 right now. So we need to accelerate our work from 15,000 per year to 75,000 per year. Because we understand and respect the operational impacts to our passengers, what we are doing is we are aggressively pursuing methods to increase our production rates within the same available production windows. We want to do more fasteners in the same amount of time. How do we do that? We're working with equipment suppliers so that we know that if we can get to drilling the fasteners out in a two-minute time frame, that we'll be able to achieve those production window, those production rates in the windows that we currently have. So we're working with suppliers to be able to provide that kind of equipment. That's why we show like a 2014 increase here, because we feel that if we, you know, that this is achievable, you know, getting the equipment that's necessary and to be able to do this work. So again, you know, we recognize that the limited production windows we have, it's not a matter of simply getting more production windows. It's a matter of increasing that production efficiency. Yes.
Certainly.
So the 75,000 production rate is what you would need to achieve to get to the steady state. Once you achieve the steady state, it's no longer 75,000. It's really, what is the?
20,000.
It's 20,000 once you get
point.
There.
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
That's the gulf between steady state of quality and not.
Yes.
Ms. Porter.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say I still like this chart very much, and I particularly like sticking the picture of the fastener in the corner. When I first read it, though, I couldn't make out the labels, and I think that because I wasn't sure what work plan and backlog were in relationship to the thing, so I think you could just using something like planned replacements and remaining to be replaced, I think, would be simpler. But I still really like this chart, and I would encourage us to use this as part of our communication with customers, because I think it really does show in a very intuitive way exactly why we're doing the work that we're doing, at least this is in terms of the fasteners. I really think it's a very good communication tool.
Thank you. I want to say that the capital investment is making a difference in our performance. We collect data on every type of delay within the system and what system contributed to that specific delay. This may include ATC, track issues, traction power, vehicles, and also type of the component, down to the component type that caused the delay, whether they be specifically track circuit switch machines, door issues, or track issues. When we analyze the delay per month by track circuit performance, simply stated, delays caused by track circuits, we can see a positive trend in the reduction of this type of delay on the red line. Now, why is this important? Why do I bring this graph forward? Positive performance of a track circuit is a system that relies on many different subcomponents of the railroad to be in a state of good repair. Condition of rail, condition of roadbed, condition of fasteners, condition of ties, good traction return, condition of track connections, condition of the rail, and the track circuit electronic module itself, all work as an integrated system. The track circuit is dependent upon all those components to be in good working condition. When we look at this, this is somewhat like bringing the canary into the mine. If the canary is alive and well, chances are the environment that is in is acceptable. It's the same thing here. If your track circuit is alive and well, chances are that the environment that it's working in is acceptable or in a state of good repair. But we can see a positive trend downward, which lets us see that our efforts are working. The capital program is improving the railroad and the transportation system as a whole. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Staff? Mr. Belcher?
Update on no, that's next. No, advertising's next on the agenda.
That's next one. All right. Next up on our marathon session is the WMATA advertising program.
There were lemons.
Before
we will. The item coming up next as part of the Finance Committee is a response to the both public and board interest in the advertising history of our program. General Counsel O'Keefe is going to go through the history, and should there be any other questions regarding legal matters, they will be heard in executive session, and so we can hold those until we have an executive session.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the board. My purpose here today, as Mrs. Hudgens has said, is to tell you where we are and how we got here with respect to our advertising program. So the first thing I want to say is this entire discussion and every legal decision that arises in the context of First Amendment rights in advertising such as we have is driven by something called form analysis, which I'll get to a little bit later. But there are three types of form: public, traditional public, non-traditional, which is where we are, designated, and then non-public. And everything I say has to be seen in the context of what category we fall into currently. And we fall into that category currently because of actions that the board has taken in the past and how those actions have been interpreted by the courts. So, next slide, please. The first little bit of history is that WMATA's first advertising guidelines were adopted in 1972. They were quite brief. And then again in 1980, the board took an action which reserved a part of the advertising space for public service ads. And from the outset, the board's actions with respect to the public service ads were clear and were intended to restrict that space to certain types of messages. And as the years went by, the board's actions made that space even more restricted. So in the advertising forum, WMATA has two types of advertising, the public service and the commercial. And the commercial is everything that people pay for. So it's all types of ads, not just the type of ad where people are trying to sell goods and services. Now, in 1997, the board took a very important action with respect to all of its property, all of the WMATA property. It adopted a little-known document called the Use Regulation for short, the WMATA regulation concerning use of property by others. And that regulation, and it's still in effect, it's been updated many times through the years, was the board's action to designate what can occur on all of its property, all of the buses, trains, this building, everywhere, the parking lots. And that was the primary way the board created the legal framework for how we view all the property, whether it is a public forum, and we aren't public because WMATA's space is not the type of public space that's traditionally been viewed as a free speech arena. Those are, of course, parks, sidewalks, streets, the kind of space for which the public has always used the area for free expression. We're not there. We're in a non-traditional or designated public forum, and the board started the major designation in 1987. So in what I will refer to as the use regulation, every location where advertising, for example, is permitted is identified. The particular parts of the stations, the particular part of the buses, the particular part of the railways. It even addresses what type of advertising is permitted on WMATA's website. So the board has taken through the years a number of actions to define and circumscribe what can occur on the property. So, for example, there's an area around the stations, and it's really designated as 15 feet back from various parts of the station, the entrance to the escalators, the front entrance, and so forth. And those areas have been designated free speech for the purposes of people coming there and handing out literature. And people, you see them quite a lot, flyers, political announcements, and so forth. But what the board did not permit in that very limited area was any type of commercial activity, selling things, advertising to sell things, even handing out free items as a form of commercial speech because you're trying to sell an item. So the board's definition of free speech is quite specific, and it is not the entire range of constitutionally protected free speech. And that occurs around the front areas of the stations. It is not permitted in the paid areas of the stations, in the buses, on the platforms, in the trains. The only area that the board has actually designated the type of free speech as far as talking, handing out flyers and so forth, is that limited area. And again, the advertising areas are quite specifically defined. So the use regulation, which is fairly long, it's been amended a number of times. For example, certain limited types of activities can occur in parking lots at certain times. Certain things have to come back to the board for approval, but that is really how the board defined what I will refer to later as the forum.
Mr. Chairman or Madam Chair, may I ask a question? Just in terms of the 50 feet, could you?
15.
15 feet. And could you paint a picture for me what that means? So 15 feet of what?
Well, it's 15 feet. If you want, I can read the whole thing. But it's 15 feet. For example, if you come up gallery outside of Gallery Place, come up the escalators, a lot of times you see people handing things there, handing out things. If I come out and see them, and they're real close to the escalators, I'll say, you need to stand back 15 feet. And so it's 15 feet, and sometimes that 15 feet will actually carry you out onto the sidewalk, but typically you're still on WMATA property. So it's 15 feet, and it might be 15 feet back from the entrance. In other words, when you come up Gallery Place, it's right there, and you're coming out onto the public space. If you come out of Greenbelt, it isn't the escalator, it's the entrance to the station. So the 15 feet back depends upon the configuration of the actual station.
So it's the station proper, not ancillary properties such as a parking garage or other types of facilities. It's the station proper itself.
That's where the free speech area has been designated.
Thank you.
And again, I know I'm not quite yet to the advertising, except for the advertising venues. But it's important to understand that the global designation that the board has undertaken occurs not in the commercial advertising regulations, but in the WMATA use regulation. And so, for example, people can't demonstrate in our parking garage, in our parking areas, or in the bus garages, or there are a lot of different areas where we would say that is not a public area. In fact, most of WMATA property is not a public forum. So, next slide. So, there were a couple of changes to WMATA's public service advertising generated by, in one instance, some litigation that arose that I'll talk to you about in a minute. And the final action that the board took was in 2003, and the board did reduce the space, but quite restricted the use of the public service advertising to either WMATA-sponsored ads or ads sponsored by the WMATA jurisdictions or the WMATA jurisdictions in concert with a 501c3 organization or the federal government. And it was quite restricted to certain categories of speech. So the public service space has never been a public forum, come one, come all type of advertising space. Next slide, please. So the modern era of WMATA's advertising program begins with in 1984 with the LeBron case. And I apologize for the quality. The ad that was actually run is on the left-hand side, but we don't have a real good version of it. So the one on the right-hand side is close. It's not exactly the ad, though, that we ran. So we rejected this poster. It was what's called a photo montage. So obviously it wasn't a real picture. But the ad sponsor had put together this photo montage. It was criticism directed at President Reagan. And WMATA rejected it because it viewed it to be misleading. Because, it wasn't a picture that was ever actually taken. It was a photo montage. We rejected it because we thought it misled the public. So we were sued, and we lost. And the court at that time looked at the entire context of WMATA's advertising programs and what it had accepted through the years, and held that WMATA's advertising forum, and in this instance it was really focused on the commercial advertising, constituted a designated public forum. So clearly we're not traditional because our property doesn't fall into that category. But the board concluded that by virtue of really the types of ads that the organization had accepted through the years, WMATA was a public forum. So when you get into that area of public forum, whether it's traditional or non-traditional,
I believe Mr. Dyke had a question.
Just a quick question. Was that the district court decision or appellate court? Which court? The
LeBaron? Ultimately appellate, yes.
Appellate court.
D.C., right. So, once you get into the area of a public forum, whether it is designated or traditional, the courts apply an extremely strict constitutional criteria. And we've all heard of strict scrutiny. Once it's subjected to whatever you're doing, very few people survive. So it is the most protective constitutional view of speech. Next slide. Yes.
When that decision was made back then, was there any discussion about language? Use of language, type of language,
no,
profanity, anything like that?
No, but I will get to to that issue, of course, because that's the issue we're, you know, we're most concerned about today. So, next slide. So anyway, the LeBron court held that we had improperly rejected that ad because the organization had created and designated its advertising program as a non-traditional designated forum, and strict scrutiny applies. So when that occurs, you have to have a compelling governmental reason and narrowly tailored criteria to restrict speech. Christ Pride's Ministry was an ad that was ran in 1995-96. I mention it only because it generated quite a lot of protest. It was a pro-choice ad, and it suggested that women who... What did I say?
Pro-choice.
Yeah, pro-life. It was indicating that women who choose abortion suffer more and more deadly breast cancer. So we received a lot of public comment, most of it negative, before running that, and largely because it was viewed to be misleading from a medical perspective. However, at that time, the general counsel did actually look into the literature that had been offered by the sponsoring organization and found that there was enough merit that he did not believe we could reject the ad. SEPTA, however, rejected the ads and was sued, and ultimately they won on the first round in the district court. When it went up on appeal, the court invalidated the rejection and found it was viewpoint discrimination. And of course, a predicate for that is the court's finding that SEPTA also had designated its advertising as a public forum. If there's a conclusion that a particular governmental organization has not created a public forum, then the analysis goes completely differently. Next ad. This was a highly controversial ad. I think, in my recollection, we had the single largest negative response. Now, again, concerning Mr. Yule's comment, none of these ads involved any type of profanity. These were issue ads. We ran these ads, and then the campaign concluded. Next ad,
Mr.
please.
Chairman, just the question. And I see some very small print on all of the ads. Does that indicate who's paying for them?
It shows the sponsor. Yeah, this was the global campaign to end the bishop's ban on condoms. So Catholics for free choice, I think is what it says. So next.
Just into that, to as a follow-up, these are ads that we ran.
We ran
based on our interpretation of our policy that we are required to run these.
Correct.
On
the court's view that we had created a public forum, and I might say that through those years, the board took no action to change the nature of that forum. And then we got to the Change the Climate ads. Those were in 2003. Those were not received well by Congress. And Congress passed a law prohibiting the funding of transit, if the grantee accepted ads promoting legalization or medical use of any controlled substance. So we had run the ads. They were presented to be run again, and we rejected them for obvious reasons, not wanting to jeopardize our funding. So we were not sued. The ACLU sued the government, and the challenged restriction was invalidated as viewpoint discrimination. And at the time, there was a fair amount of discussion, and the government's perspective was that we could avoid a problem by simply not running a whole category of ads, issue-related ads. I say political, but I mean it in the small p, not partisan, but advocacy ads, issue-type ads, that we could avoid our problem. But the court invalidated that restriction, and the restriction on our funding was lifted. Next ad. We've run a few other controversial ads, again, involving either the president or other prominent political figures. Again, to Mr. Yule's comment, none involving anything that we would be calling profanity. Those weren't challenged by either subject of those ads. So next. So again, where we are now, and based upon the board's history in how it has treated the commercial advertising forum, is that we fall into the area of a designated public forum. And whether there is a designated public forum or traditional public forum, the court applies a very strict standard of constitutional scrutiny. But it is important to understand that the government can redefine a non-traditional or designated public forum. What the board has defined in the first instance can be redefined. It has to be done very carefully.
Just a quick question of clarification. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
When we say the government, we're talking about in this case the iterative decisions issued by the court. Or when you say the government, what are you referring to?
WMATA.
Oh, WMATA and its governance.
Is the government. Right. WMATA is an agency of three governmental entities and is, for this purpose, treated as a governmental entity.
Okay, so your references to government in this case are WMATA.
WMATA, yes.
Thank you.
Because it's what the government has originally defined can be redefined with a great deal of care.
And just one other fine point of clarification, when you say we've run, essentially what we've run certain ads, what that essentially we're saying is we've sold space to persons or businesses that purchased advertising space, and they've run those ads. We've made the space available through a sale process or contract process.
Right. It's a revenue-generating
right.
activity, whether the ad is what we all think of as right. pure commercial, selling products, or it is a species of issue advocacy.
But just to
they still have that to pay,
though. We're not running any advertising, but we're permitting advertising to be run.
Yes, I'm sorry. It has been placed in our system consistent with our advertising program by our contractor. We have a contractor that accepts and places the ads. So the question about, and of course the issue at hand, is the use of profanity. And
before you move on to that question on, if we were to define ourselves as a non-public forum, could we accept any issue advertising?
It's a tricky thing.
Yeah. Because obviously we accept a lot of issue advertising. The Capital South is totally filled this week with Vote for Mass Transit. Yeah. The Navy Yard is full of buy ships. The Pentagon has buy planes. And, you know, if we let those in, I don't know how we could let others out. But
the answer is theoretically the forum can be defined in such a way that you could accept issue advocacy, but constrain it. It's hard to do. Certain properties have done it. In the face of a long tradition of a designated public forum, it's harder to do, but I'm not going to say it's impossible. So when you get to the issue that has prompted so much public attention, the use of profanity, when you're talking about a designated public forum, then the standard is is this. The Supreme Court generally has held that profane or vulgar speech unaccompanied by any evidence of violent arousal or obscenity are not, they don't lose their constitutional protection. Certain types of profanity would be considered obscenity. Certain types of profanity would be considered fighting words. And the court has not held those types of words to be protected. To get to that place requires a different type of forum than WMATA has now. But it is possible to create that kind of forum. And that's all I have to say.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Carroll. I think this is a good way to illuminate the issue for the public as well as for the board. And any other questions, we can address them in the second session. Thank you. All righty. With that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
I want to recognize the statement that the general manager made, who I think spoke for all of us when he said he found this to be personally offensive and unacceptable, but still fell within what was perceived to be First Amendment rights. Speaking for us, I think, in a timely fashion, with the right choice of words, was the right thing to do, and I want to publicly recognize that.
Thank you, Mr. Downs. Okay. That concludes our committee meeting. If there are no other matters to be brought before the committee, this meeting is adjourned.
Mr. Downs, would you like to, is Mr. Brown still, Matt still here?
I'm sorry.
Is Matt still here? Is he here?
Well, he's not on the agenda.
Okay. Do you want to start now, or do you?
No, why don't we?
Okay, then we can. All right. The board will convene an executive session, and we'll return afterwards for the remaining committee meetings once we conclude the session.